The record will indicate all the jurors are present, both counsel are present, parties present. Yes, sir?
Sir, may I be as bold to ask His Honor to bring the microphone a little closer?
You mean you really want to hear these instructions?
I want to give these two people an equal chance.
Okay, while I'm thinking about it, I meant to compliment the attorneys. I think you are fortunate to have a case provided by two highly qualified attorneys. Once they set the time limits for the witnesses and for all phases of the case, they've strictly abided by those time limits. So I think we all should be grateful to them. They have both done a fine job presenting their cases. You've heard all the evidence. You've heard the closing arguments of the attorneys. And now what remains is simply the jury instructions, and then you'll begin your deliberations. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it is now my duty to instruct on the law that applies to this case. It is your duty to follow the law. As jurors, it's your duty to determine the effect and value of the evidence and to decide all questions of fact. You must not be influenced by sympathy, passion, or prejudice. You must decide all questions of fact in this case from the evidence received in this trial and not from any other source. You must not make any independent investigation of the facts or the law or consider or discuss facts as to which there is no evidence. This means, for example, that you must not, on your own, visit the scene, conduct experiments, none of those. Absolutely no genotyping experiments or consult reference works for additional information. If any matter is repeated or stated in different ways in my instructions, no emphasis is intended. Do not draw any inference because of a repetition. Do not single out any individual rule or instruction and ignore the others. Consider all the instructions as a whole and each in light of the others. The order in which the instructions are given has no significance as to their relative importance. The fact that a corporation is a party must not prejudice you in your deliberations or your verdict. Do not discriminate against a corporation and natural individuals. Each is a person in the eyes of the law and entitled to the same fair and impartial consideration and to justice by the same legal standards. There is no evidence before you that any party has or does not have insurance for the plaintiff's claim. Whether such insurance exists has no bearing upon any issue in this case. You must not discuss or consider it for any purpose. The pronoun forum, as used in these instructions, if applicable, as shown by the text of the instruction and the evidence, applies to a corporation. In this trial, the plaintiff is Tony Zarnik, an individual, and the defendant is Illumina, Incorporated, a corporation. Dr. Zarnik is seeking to recover compensatory damages against defendant Illumina based upon claims of disability, discrimination, retaliation, and wrongful termination in violation of public policy. Evidence means testimony, writings, material objects, or other things presented to the senses and offered to prove the existence or non-existence of a fact. Evidence is either direct or circumstantial. Direct evidence proves a fact without an inference, and if true, conclusively establishes that fact. Circumstantial evidence proves a fact from which an inference of the existence of another fact or facts may be drawn. An inference is a deduction of fact that may logically and reasonably be drawn from another fact or group of facts established by the evidence. The law makes no distinction between direct and circumstantial evidence as to the degree of proof required. Each is a reasonable method of proof. Each is respected for such convincing force as it may carry. Weighing conflicting testimony. You are not required to decide any issue according to the testimony of a number of witnesses which does not convince you as against the testimony of a smaller number or other evidence which is more convincing to you. The testimony of one witness worthy of belief is sufficient to prove any fact. This does not mean that you are free to disregard the testimony of any witness merely from caprice or prejudice, or from a desire to favor either side. It does mean that you must not decide anything by simply counting the number of witnesses who have testified on the opposing sides. The test is not the number of witnesses, but the convincing force of the evidence. If weaker and less satisfactory evidence is offered by a party, when it was within such party's ability to produce stronger and more satisfactory evidence, the evidence offered should be viewed with distrust. Failure to deny or explain adverse evidence. In determining what inferences to draw from the evidence, you may consider, among other things, a party's failure to explain or deny such evidence. limited admission of evidence. Certain evidence was admitted for a limited purpose. Do not consider it for any other purpose. Your attention was called to these matters when the evidence was admitted. Deposition testimony. Testimony has been read from depositions. A deposition is testimony taken under oath before a trial and preserved in writing. You must consider that testimony as if it had been given here in court. Interrogatories. An interrogatory is a written question asked by one party of another who must answer it under oath and in writing. You must consider interrogatories and the answers thereto just as if the question had been asked and answered here in court. Believability of witnesses. You are the sole and exclusive judges of the believability of the witnesses and the weight to be given to the testimony of each witness. In determining the believability of a witness, you must consider any matter that has a tendency in reason to prove or disprove the truthfulness of the testimony of a witness, including but not limited to the following: the demeanor and the manner of the witness while testifying, the character and quality of that testimony, the extent of the capacity of the witness to perceive, to recollect, or to communicate any matter about which the witness testified, the opportunity of the witness to perceive any matter about which the witness has testified, the existence or non-existence of a bias, interest, or other motive, a statement previously made by the witness that is inconsistent or consistent with the testimony of the witness, the existence or non-existence of any fact testified to by the witness, the attitude of the witness toward this action or toward the giving of testimony, an admission by the witness of untruthfulness, the character of the witness for honesty or truthfulness, or their opposites. Discrepancies in testimony. Discrepancies in a witness's testimony or between such witness's testimony and that of other witnesses, if there were any, do not necessarily mean that any such witness should be discredited. Failure of recollection is common. Innocent misrecollection is not uncommon. Two persons witnessing an incident or a transaction often will see or hear it differently. Whether a discrepancy pertains to an important matter or only to something trivial should be considered by you. Witness willfully false. A witness false in one part of his or her testimony is to be distrusted in others. You may reject the entire testimony of a witness who willfully has testified falsely on a material point unless, from all the evidence, you believe that the probability of truth favors his or her testimony in other particulars. Extrajudicial admissions. A statement made by a party before trial which tends to prove or disprove any material fact in this action and which is against such party's interest is an admission. Evidence of an oral admission not made under oath should be viewed with caution. No unfavorable inference from exercise of a privilege. If at a deposition or in answers to interrogatories, a privilege not to testify with respect to any matter or refuse to disclose or present another from disclosing any matter has been exercised, no assumption of fact is to be made by you because of the exercise of such privilege, and you must not draw any inference therefrom as to the believability of the witness or as to any matter in issue in this trial. Expert testimony. Qualifications of expert. Witnesses who have special knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education in a particular subject have testified to certain opinions. Any such witness is referred to as an expert witness. In determining what weight to give any such opinion, you should consider the qualifications and the believability of the witness, the facts or materials upon which each opinion is based, and the reasons for each opinion. An opinion is only as good as the facts and reasons on which it is based. If you find that any such fact has not been proved or has been disproved, you must consider that in determining the strengths and weaknesses of the reasons on which it is based. You are not bound by an opinion. Give each opinion the weight you find it deserves. However, you may not arbitrarily or unreasonably disregard the expert testimony in this case. Weighing conflicting expert testimony. In resolving the conflict in the testimony of expert witnesses, you should weigh the opinion of one expert against that of another. In doing this, you should consider the qualifications and believability of each witness, the reasons for each opinion, and the matter upon which they are based. Hypothetical questions. A hypothetical question is a question in which an expert witness is asked to assume that certain facts are true and to give an opinion based upon that assumption. If any fact assumed in such a question has not been established by the evidence, you should determine the effect of that omission upon the value of an opinion based on that fact. Burden of proof and preponderance of the evidence. Plaintiff is seeking damages based upon claims of disability, discrimination, retaliation, and wrongful termination in violation of public policy. Plaintiff has the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence all of the facts necessary to establish the essential elements of each separate claim. The essential elements of each separate claim are set forth elsewhere in these instructions. In addition to these essential elements, the plaintiff has the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence all the facts necessary to establish the nature and extent of the damages claimed to have been suffered, the elements of the plaintiff's damage, and the amount thereof. Preponderance of the evidence means evidence that has more convincing force than that opposed to it. If the evidence is so evenly balanced that you're unable to say that the evidence on either side of an issue preponderates, your finding on that issue shall be against the party who has the burden of proving it. You should consider all the evidence bearing upon every issue, regardless of who produced it. Burden of proof and clear and convincing evidence. The plaintiff has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence all the facts necessary to establish whether there was oppression, malice, or fraud in any conduct upon which you may base any finding of liability. Clear and convincing evidence means evidence that has such convincing force that it demonstrates, in contrast to the opposing evidence, a high probability of the truth of the facts for which it is offered as proof. Such evidence requires a higher standard of proof than proof by a preponderance of the evidence. You should consider all the evidence bearing upon every issue, regardless of who produced it. Wrongful termination, violation of public policy, essential elements. The plaintiff seeks to recover damages based upon a claim of wrongful termination in violation of public policy. The essential elements of such a claim are, 1. Plaintiff was employed by defendant, 2. The defendant terminated plaintiff's employment in violation of the public policy, and 3. The termination caused plaintiff to suffer injury, damage, loss, or harm. Violation of public policy defined. The termination of an employee by an employer in violation of public policy is a wrongful termination. An employee who is terminated in violation of public policy is entitled to recover damages from the employer. To establish a termination of employment in violation of public policy, it must be established that the termination of plaintiff's employment was a violation of public policy. The public policy of the state of California and the United States is that a company may not make any representations or omissions of material facts to potential investors that the company knew or should have known were false or misleading in connection with the sale of or offer to sell stock or other securities. If you find that plaintiff is entitled to recover damages for wrongful termination in violation of public policy, such damages must include the value of any economic losses suffered by the plaintiff as a result and any damages for emotional distress suffered by plaintiff. Employment discrimination. The plaintiff also seeks to recover damages based upon a claim that the defendant engaged in certain unlawful employment practices under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, known as FEHA, FEHA. The FEHA, or FEHA, makes it an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate against any employee upon certain basis, including, but not limited to, a mental disability. Plaintiff has alleged that the defendant engaged in the unlawful employment practice of discrimination based upon the plaintiff's mental disability, major depression. Plaintiff's allegations of discrimination are based upon the theory of disparate treatment. Disparate treatment means that the employer treats some individual less favorably than others because of the disability. Disparate treatment generally requires proof that the plaintiff's disability was a motivating factor of the improper treatment. Employment discrimination, disparate treatment. The essential elements that are claimed for unlawful employment discrimination on the basis of disability are 1. The defendant was an employer. 2. The plaintiff was an employee of the defendant. 3. The defendant made a decision adverse to the plaintiff in regards to compensation or terms, conditions, or privileges of employment, including but not limited to termination of plaintiff's employment. 4. The plaintiff's disability was a motivating factor in the defendant's conduct. And 5. The defendant's conduct has caused plaintiff injury, damage, loss, or harm. A motivating factor is something that moves the will and induces action, even though other matters may have contributed to the taking of the action. Retaliation. The essential elements of the claim for unlawful employment retaliation are 1. The defendant was an employer. 2. Plaintiff was an employee of the defendant. 3. Plaintiff engaged in a legally protected activity, namely, making a complaint that he believed he had been discriminated against by his employer. 4. The defendant subjected plaintiff to adverse employment action, including but not limited to termination of employment. 5. Plaintiff's protected activity was a motivating factor for the defendant's adverse employment action. And 6. The defendant's action caused plaintiff injury, damage, loss, or harm. The essential elements of the claim for unlawful disability discrimination are 1. The plaintiff is an individual with a mental or physical disability. 2. The defendant was an employer. 3. Plaintiff was an employee of the defendant. 4. The defendant subjected plaintiff to adverse employment action, including but not limited to termination of employment. 5. The plaintiff's disability was a motivating factor for the defendant's adverse employment action. And 6. The defendant's action caused plaintiff to suffer injury, damage, loss, or harm. Mental disability includes, but is not limited to, all of the following. 1. Having any mental or psychological disorder or condition, such as mental retardation, organic brain syndrome, emotional or mental illness, or specific learning disabilities that limits a major life activity. 2. Having a record or history of a mental or psychological disorder or condition described in paragraph 1, which is known to the employer. Or 3. Being regarded or treated by the employer as having or having had a mental or psychological disorder or condition that has no present disabling effect but that may become a mental disability as described in paragraph 1. Limits shall be determined without regard to mitigating measures such as medication or reasonable accommodations unless the mitigating measure itself limits a major life activity. It's a major life activity if it makes the achievement of the major life activity difficult. Major life activity shall be broadly construed and includes physical, mental, and social activities and working. Now, just in case there's one or two of you that hasn't gotten each of these points down up until now, and there's still more to go, I won't keep you in suspense any longer. These instructions will be made available to you in written form for use in the jury room, but the law requires that I read them to you. Special jury instruction number 1, mental disability, discrimination. The evidence has established and the parties have agreed that Dr. Zarnik suffers from chronic major depression. You are instructed that Dr. Zarnik's depression is a disability for purposes of our state discrimination law, known as California Fair Employment Housing Act, also FEHA, also FEHA, all the same thing. Retaliation, good faith belief. In order to prevail on his claim that Illumina retaliated against him because he complained about disability discrimination, Dr. Zarnik does not have to prove that he was actually discriminated against. Rather, Dr. Zarnik need only prove that he had a good faith belief he was being discriminated against and Illumina took adverse action against him in whole or in part because he complained about discrimination. The law prohibits employers from retaliating against employees who make good faith complaints of discrimination, whether or not any discrimination actually occurred. Whistleblowing, good faith belief. In order to prevail on his whistleblower claim, Dr. Zarnik does not have to prove Illumina actually did disclose information or conclusions derived from the 768 decoding experiment on its roadshow. Rather, Dr. Zarnik need only prove that, 1. He had a reasonable belief that Illumina may have used or was planning to use such information or conclusions in its roadshow presentations in a manner that would be misleading to potential investors. 2. He raised his concerns that Illumina may have used or was planning to use such information or conclusions in its roadshow presentations, and 3, Illumina took adverse action against him in whole or in part because he raised such concerns. Employers may not take retaliation against employees who reasonably blow the whistle on possible wrongdoing, whether or not any violation of law actually occurred. Discrimination, retaliation need not be sole factor. In order to prove his employment was terminated on account of his disability, complaint of discrimination, and or whistleblowing, Dr. Zarnik is not required to prove that his disability, complaint of discrimination, or whistleblowing was the sole reason or even the primary reason for Illumina's action. There may be more than one reason or factor influencing an employer's decision. Dr. Zarnik need only show that his disability, complaints of discrimination, or whistleblowing was a motivating factor in the decision to terminate. Retaliation. Timing of employer's action may prove motive. The timing of an employer's adverse employment action may tend to prove employer's motive. An employer's retaliatory motive may be proved by showing that the employee engaged in protected activity, such as making a complaint of discrimination or opposing what he reasonably believes to be conduct by the employer that is illegal, and that the employer's adverse employment action followed within a relatively short time thereafter. However, timing alone does not necessarily prove motive. You must determine motive based upon all of the circumstances, including timing. Pretext. If you find that Illumina's explanation for terminating Dr. Zarnik's employment or taking other adverse employment action against him is a pretext for discrimination or retaliation, you may find in favor of Dr. Zarnik. The word pretext, as used in these instructions, means a false reason or excuse designed to hide the real reason. Employer's duty to investigate discrimination. Employers are required by law to investigate claims of discrimination and take prompt corrective action to remedy discrimination. You may consider the fact that Illumina did not investigate Dr. Zarnik's claim of discrimination in deciding whether Illumina discriminated or retaliated against Dr. Zarnik, and whether Illumina did or did not investigate Dr. Zarnik's claim does not necessarily prove that any discrimination or retaliation occurred or that Illumina acted with malice. At-will employment. The fact that you may have seen or heard that Dr. Zarnik was an at-will employee has no bearing on this case. You are not to consider such evidence in your deliberations. Separate claims. In this case, Dr. Zarnik has made claims against Illumina on the basis of 3 separate legal claims. You are to decide each claim separately. The fact you may decide one claim in favor of a particular party does not necessarily mean that you must decide any other claim or claims in favor of that same party. Damages. If you find that the plaintiff is entitled to recover damages for unlawful employment discrimination and/or retaliation, the damages must include the value of any loss of compensation and benefits suffered as a result of the discrimination and/or retaliation, and any damages for emotional discredits suffered by plaintiff, provided that you find that the loss or harm was or will be suffered by the plaintiff and was or will be caused by the act or omission upon which you base your finding of liability. Emotional distress. If you find that plaintiff is entitled to a verdict against defendant, you must then award plaintiff damages in an amount that will reasonably compensate plaintiff for all loss or harm, provided that you find it was or will be suffered by the plaintiff and was caused by the defendant's conduct. The amount of such award shall include reasonable compensation for any fears, anxiety, or other emotional distress suffered by the plaintiff and for similar suffering reasonably certain to be experienced in the future from the same cause. This is a non-economic damage. No definite standard or methodical calculation is prescribed by law by which to fix reasonable compensation for emotional distress. Nor is the opinion of any witness required as to the amount of such reasonable compensation. Furthermore, the arguments of counsel as to the amount of damages is not evidence of reasonable compensation. In making an award for emotional distress, you shall exercise your authority with calm and reasonable judgment, and the damages you fix shall be just and reasonable in light of the evidence. Illumina Incorporated is a corporation and as such can act only through its officers and employees. Any act or omission of an officer or employee within the scope of authority or employment is in law the act or omission of such corporation. Punitive damages. If you find that plaintiff suffered actual injury, harm, or damage caused by disability discrimination, retaliation, or wrongful termination in violation of public policy, you must decide in addition whether by clear and convincing evidence you find that there was oppression, malice, or fraud in the conduct on which you base your finding of liability. Oppression means despicable conduct that subjects a person to cruel and unjust hardship in conscious disregard of that person's rights. Malice means conduct which is intended by the defendant to cause injury to the plaintiff, or despicable conduct which is carried on by the defendant with a willful and conscious disregard for the rights of others. Despicable conduct is conduct which is so contemptible, miserable, or loathsome that it would be looked down upon and despised by ordinary decent people. Fraud means an intentional misrepresentation, deceit, or concealment of a material fact known to the defendant with the intention on the part of the defendant of thereby depriving a person of property or legal rights or otherwise causing injury. You must now determine whether you should award...
I don't think this should be read.
This is too soon. That's for later on. Only if needed. The terms managing agent includes only those corporate employees who exercise substantial independent authority and judgment in their corporate decision-making so that their decisions ultimately determine corporate policy. The mere ability to hire and fire employees is not in itself sufficient.
Your Honor, I think the second portion of this instruction may be premature as well.
Okay. Actually, we'll delete that at this time and then we'll give it later on if necessary. You agree with that, Mr. Pantone?
Yes.
Jury not to take cue from judge. I have not intended by anything I've said or done or by any questions that I've asked to suggest how you should decide any question of fact or that I believe or disbelieve any witness. If anything I have done or said has seemed to so indicate, you must disregard it and form your own opinion. I'm not going to use the next one. The purpose of the court's instructions is to instruct you as to the applicable law so that you may arrive at a just and lawful verdict. Whether some instructions apply will depend upon what you find to be the facts. Even though I've instructed you on various subjects, including damages, you must not treat the instructions as indicating the court's opinion on how you should decide any issue in this case or as to which party is entitled to your verdict. In the jury room, it is your duty to discuss the case in order to reach an agreement if you can. Each of you must decide the case for yourself, but should do so only after considering the views of each juror. You should not hesitate to change an opinion if you are convinced it is wrong. However, you should not be influenced to decide any question in a particular way simply because a majority of the jurors or any one of them favors such a decision. How juries should approach their task. The attitude and conduct of jurors at the beginning of their deliberations are very important. It is rarely helpful for a juror on entering the jury room to express an emphatic opinion on the case or announce a determination to stand for a certain verdict. When one does that at the outset, a sense of pride may be aroused and one may hesitate to change an opinion, even if shown it is wrong. Remember, you are not partisans or advocates in this matter. You must be impartial judges of the facts. Ladies and gentlemen, you must not determine any issue in this case by chance, such as a flip of a coin, drawing of lots, or any other chance determination. I always get worried when the jury doesn't laugh at that. For example, if you determine that a party is entitled to recover, you must not arrive at any amount of damages to be awarded by agreeing in advance to determine an average and make that your verdict without further exercise of your independent consideration, judgment, and decision. The instructions which I'm now giving you will be made available in written form for your deliberations. You may find that the instructions may be typed, printed, or handwritten. Portions may have been added or deleted. You must disregard any deleted part of an instruction and not speculate as to what it was or as to the reasons for its deletion. You are not to be concerned with the reasons for any modification. Every part of the text of an instruction, whether typed, printed, or handwritten, is of equal importance. You should be governed by the instruction in its final wording. You will be permitted to separate at the noon and evening recess. During your absence, the courtroom will be locked. During such periods of recess, you must not discuss with anyone any subject connected with this trial, and you must not deliberate further upon the case until all 12 of you are together and reassembled in the jury room. At such time, you should notify the bailiff that the jury is reassembled and continue your deliberations. You shall now retire and select one of your number to act as foreperson. Your foreperson shall preside over your deliberations. All jurors should participate in all deliberations and vote on each issue. Answer the questions according to the directions on the form and all the instructions of the court. If 9 or more can agree on the answer, you should return a special verdict in the form of written answers to questions on a form you'll be given. As soon as 9 or more jurors have agreed upon each answer, have the answer signed and dated by your foreperson and return with it to this room. It need not be the same 9 or more jurors who agree on each answer to the questions. You may be polled in open court. If so, each juror must be able to state truthfully that the answer does or does not express his or her vote. So we have prepared to assist you the special verdict form, which you've already seen. The purpose of this form really is to walk you through the questions you need to answer and then to direct you in such a way you don't answer questions you don't have to answer. So, for example, question 1, do you find that Illumina terminated Dr. Zarnik's employment in whole or in part because of his disability, depression? Answer, yes or no. As soon as 9 or more of you have agreed on an answer, the foreperson records that answer. Then, in this case, you move on to the next one. At other points in the verdict form, it will tell you, for example, question number 7. Do you find that Dr. Zarnik raised concerns to anyone at Illumina about what he reasonably believed to be Illumina's use or planned use of information or upon conclusions derived from the 768 decoding experiment in its roadshow presentation to potential investors? Yes or no. As soon as 9 or more agree, the foreperson records the answer, and if you answered yes, you go on to the next. If you answered no, you skip to question 10, so forth. The form tells you what to do. Now, the original is a white form, and we've made copies for each of you, which are what color?
Green.
Green. The green ones are for you to record your own decision. At the end of the case, when you announce your verdict, you may be polled. Each of you has your individual answers to each one of the questions, so you can use the green form to record your own individual answer. And we do that to make sure 9 or more of you actually agree on the answers. The green form will assist you because there are so many questions that you may be called upon to answer. That way you can recall how you answered each question. Before the foreperson records the yes or no answer, you should do your own yes or no in the same blank. A couple of other things. With regard to jury questions, questions may be sent to the court in written form through the foreperson. As far as mechanics of getting a question answered, once I receive the question, I will attempt to locate the attorneys. It's possible that one of them or both of them may be involved in another courtroom somewhere, so that sometimes takes time. Then we have to get together either telephonically or oftentimes they just come into the courtroom and we try to agree on an answer as to your question. That takes time. So, if you write us a question and you don't get an answer right away, it's not that we're ignoring the question. It's that, mechanically, that it may take a while to get everybody together and formulate an answer. Again, on the subject of questions, questions generally concern either the law or the facts. As far as the law is concerned, the jury instructions are our best attempt to give you all the law that we think you'll need to resolve the questions in the case. So before you send us a question, make sure that the question is not already answered in the jury instructions. As far as the facts are concerned, generally the recollection of 12 people such as yourselves, who are paying very close attention, many of you taking notes, is excellent. Try to rely upon your own independent recollection. If you need to have read, if you need to have testimony, some portions of the testimony have already been put into transcripts, but the vast bulk of the testimony and the arguments, generally there's been a suggestion you could have the arguments read back, and that's a little unusual, the arguments of the attorneys. But if you ask for that, we can discuss it, but we don't have a transcript of that, just as we don't have a transcript of most of the testimony. So most of the time, if you ask a question, we're going to have to send the reporter into the jury room and have the reporter read back testimony. Oftentimes, it's hard to pinpoint the exact testimony that you want read back, or it involves some judgment on our part, which is really your job to decide facts. So oftentimes we end up having the reporter read back the entire direct and cross-examination of the witness, which is very time-consuming. So that can be done if it's absolutely necessary. Try to rely upon your independent recollection if you can. As far as the exhibits are concerned, we've had hundreds of documents displayed or referred to in the case. Not all of those have been admitted into evidence. Those which have been admitted into evidence will be sent into the jury room. As to those that aren't sent into the jury room, they are not admitted, and you'll have to rely upon your recollection of whatever it is that was said about them, testified to, or whatever, if they were displayed, if you can recall. But generally, only those exhibits that have been admitted are the ones that are going to be sent into the jury room. Anything else that counsel want to bring to my attention before we have the bailiff sworn?
No, Your Honor.